I noticed that Susan and Johanna and some of us in the first panel are all talking about congresses, and it strikes me that so much of this, these insider-outsider labels are performative, aren't they? They're about decorations, about, we know now the kind of something about the role of international conferences in this whole new international world of the interwar and post-war eras, but something about insiders and outsiders is about flagging it up, making a mark at these big gatherings of many different delegates. And I wonder whether, that, I mean, there's obviously a lot more going on, but I wonder to what extent you can identify with this performative side of it. Doesn't really fit, sorry, Sarah, I'm not including you in this.
So interesting, Jessica, because of course, I mean, it's tempting to say that a lot of the activity of what I call the strangers or the representatives is performative. But in fact, the reason I put the Congress of 1935 out at the center of the paper is because it's a radical break with what Houbakin and his counterparts in Germany, in England, in Italy are trying to do, which is not to disrupt or to engage in a public way, but to build slowly networks of researchers to insert themselves wherever they could in a way which would suggest we're not outsiders, we're not coming in a way which will shock you, but we are part of you, we could be part of you. And it's that, I mean, I was thinking, if I can just redirect for a minute, I was listening to you, Johanna, with such interest, the competitive approach, it did not characterize the 20s to early 30s. There was nothing against which the Soviets, when they went to Geneva, they didn't say, we are better than you. We are like you. Let us in. And I think that's a major difference. But I get the performative question. But I think if one looked at the activity of these representatives over a large spectrum, it's a minor part of their activity, not one that they would themselves favor.
I'm still thinking about how to respond, because I see the congresses in the context of the other institutions of opening. So tourism, for example, is also a process of opening the borders and allowing Soviets into the West. And it's true that these anyone who had contact with international experts or counterparts, they were vetted, and they were at least tourists, for example, were trained in how to talk about the Soviet Union, what to discuss, how to represent themselves, how to behave in a sort of well-mannered way. And so there is a performing of their like cultural achievements and a performance of, but it's sort of in a personal, to be personally representing the state, essentially. But when I think of this Congress in the context of the development of architecture, the de-Stalinization of architecture, the relish with which the architects embraced contact with architects abroad, and it seems that it was actually a very earnest contact and a real celebration of the post-Stalinist sort of thaw. They were experiencing the thaw in this way, and so in that regard, I feel there's a tension between the need to represent the Soviet Union in the best possible light and this real openness and real curiosity and really earnest exchange. It's part of that sort of the falling away of the performance that I think makes that distinction between the socialist experts and the experts in the West sort of more clear. They're interested in getting to know experts from all over the world. And so I wouldn't say that, at least in this Congress, that performance was the leading card. It was more of a genuine opening and engagement with de-Stalinization. So, I think.
Yeah, I come into the question. I think something that all three of you touched upon, and some Marx than others, Joanna, when you're talking about the architects, it sort of speaks to the questions that Jessica was raising about
what, you know, the context in which health was operated in, and also who was, you know, discussing it. From a historiographical perspective, historians of medicine don't tend to look at, you know, what architects are talking about, usually, only very directly. And of course, there are a lot of literature, hospital architecture and architecture for health, but not, you know, from this other way around. And well, Sarah, it's for you, it's completely explicit that, anyone working on health in Eastern Europe know that these narratives are completely missing from the historiography, and these stories are outsiders to a broader discussion as well. And Susan, you also mentioned this kind of omission from historiography, these moments and these from both sides, from Eastern looking inward, both East and West. So I was I don't know, maybe we can think a bit more about certain questions being outsiders, not just actors being outsiders, but the outsiders of in historiography. And my question is for Johanna is, you mentioned that there were these two questionnaires in two different languages and they were slightly different. And I already had that, you know, like, that's interesting. Well, first of all, why the questions are slightly different, but also knowing what Sarah also mentioned, that Russian is really not like the strong language in Eastern Europe at this time. I mean, really, it's French, German, and English that people are communicating even within the bloc. So I was wondering if you would like. Where the Eastern Bloc, you know, architects and organizations are, were they something like the French ones, and how that, why that difference, and if you could address that kind of language issue in this.
Yeah, thank you. Well, first on the maybe I'll start at that. On the first question that so I mean, really, I am interested in architects discussing health and architects and urban planners engaging with questions of health. And I do think this is part of the socialist model of public health, that the urban planners and architects were deeply engaged in questions of health and were very close to physicians working together collaboratively to create healthy environments tied to a very environmental approach to health in the Soviet Union. And so what they were describing actually in this Congress was, I mean, they were discussing health. This was one of their first topics, was how to create a healthy neighborhood where all of the services were integrated into the urban plan, including a lot of green space for health. And the contrast was so stark reading the reports next to each other, the American side talking about parking and the West and the Soviet side discussing, you know, creating, and they were very focused on an urban environment that would increase longevity. So if you created the most healthy city possible, people would live longer. And so they're very close to those ideas, and it is how I came to study urban planning, is because I saw that how engaged they actually were in the question of creating a healthy city and ameliorating the effects of industrialization. So it is an interesting question, sort of how to integrate this really stark difference of the Soviet model of health into our discussions in history of medicine or history of urban planning or environmental history, which is what I do, and I end up sort of presenting it all around. But and in terms of the questionnaire, I don't have that much. It's mentioned in fragments, but I believe that most of the Eastern Bloc participants are filling out the French questionnaire. Mm-hmm. I think the Bulgarians are using the Russian one, which makes sense. But And the difference mostly was, it seems that some of the French questions were embedded, so very long questions, and they were broken down into pieces, into separate questions in the Russian questionnaire. But it seems that they were especially pressing in the Russian questionnaire questions, and this is sort of points to that sort of Western orient, origin of the UIA. There are questions about democratic participation in urban planning questions and processes. So what sort of civil institutions are involved in planning urban spaces. So, and in terms of, it seems that, I unfortunately can't really speak more about it just because I only saw those fragments that there are the two different languages, but yeah.
Let me come at your question, Dora, about whether or not the Soviets were outsiders, because that, I think, is one that's interested me for a long time, and I hope some of the audience too. I have two difficulties with thinking about them as outsiders. First, the main one is that they never thought of themselves as outsiders. They simply thought they hadn't yet breached certain international organizations. They weren't invited as much as they wanted. And that some journals were closed to them, some meetings were closed to them. But they never formulated it as, we are outsiders. And what's interesting to me, again, the book that I cited, it would be case closed if the Soviets had either an approach of superiority or one of inferiority. But the same Soviet spokesman in different contexts could express a sense of, our plan for this is superior. Oh, we don't have that kind of technology. We're not quite up to standard. So there's a sense of being continually off balance. The second thing I really want to emphasize, let's simply use language in a commonsensical way. If you come to see me in Canada and I am not a British subject, you won't say to me, you are an outsider. You come to see me and you engage me in my home turf. The only time you might call me an outsider is if I attempt to come to the UK and show up and present myself as someone who is native. In other words, the minute you think about the term outsider as a term, he's already partly in. And I think that's how I think of the Soviets, on a spectrum. If they were outsiders, we wouldn't be talking about them. Reichman wouldn't be trying to get their data and get their health experts involved. The Rockefeller wouldn't be reaching out to them. So there's something about outsiders which for me doesn't quite take account of the fact that they were partly inside. But that's why I like Zimmel, because that stranger may leave tomorrow. He may leave of his own accord, or he may be kicked out of an organization. But for the meantime, he's there. He's not like the wanderer, but he is at least partly on the scene, never mind insiders, outsiders. Let me just throw that out and see what it gets from people.
Could I respond as well? I think in response to what you were just saying, thinking that through in terms of Czechoslovak culture, there's very much a sense in which they did consider themselves, and still do often, and I don't wish to stereotype too much, as outsiders, and desperately wish to overcome it. So I think there's a degree to which this, in both directions, desperately wanting to be part of international health communities, being part of international scientific communities, learning English, learning French, learning German, travelling to the West, but then also the ones who become Communist Party members, learn Russian, go and speak in China. There's a big sense of marginalisation, and I think in terms of their political history, in terms of victimisation as well, and a lack of recognition of the value of what they can contribute to the world, and that actually becomes a huge driving force for them then becoming linked up and innovating and producing all this stuff. And I think, I don't know, I feel this sort of sense of, you can probably see it coming through my own historiography here, but I have a certain degree of sympathy for that. You know, I think even now, the fact that this is still being kind of written out of the history is a big disservice to the real kind of level of engagement and intellectual development and cultural development that happened in this part of Europe during the 20th century. So, yeah.
Maria, this is related, Lindor. I want to sort of interject this here. As we were talking, Susan says this wonderful idea about superiority and inferiority complexes at the same time. Both Johanna and Sarah actually talked about the Soviet bloc and the relationship within it. And sort of, it's not just about retelling that kind of top-down narrative, which now becomes a kind of strawman argument, at least in this room. But sort of turning it on its head and saying, well, actually, there was a lot of expertise traveling from Central and Eastern Europe to the Soviet Union. And I wonder if that is the case with your Soviet architects in 1958, as they're introduced to both Western and East European architects. Is that kind of a colonial relationship in the other direction? But I was just wondering, in a broader sense, could we talk about, when we talk about the Soviet sphere and the Eastern Bloc, and if we think about that strange traveling of expertise from Central and Eastern Europe to the Soviet Union, can we talk about the Soviets as sort of outsiders within the Eastern Bloc itself, as a sort of, and also both having a superiority and inferiority complex when they talk with the Hungarians, with the Czechs, and with the Poles, and sort of perhaps with the Yugoslavs, definitely not with Bulgarians, but I was just thinking about that. The joke was about Bulgarians anyway. I mean, the superiority in the sense that they are bringing the revolution, they're bringing the final stage of enlightenment and development to the Eastern Bloc, but at the same time, inferiority, as you said, there's so much expertise that the Soviets feel like they need to learn from the Bloc. Sorry.
In terms of, it's a very interesting relationship to Bulgaria and Romania, because the Soviet sort of legal apparatus of allowing paid vacations to workers creates in some ways mass tourism in Bulgaria and Romania, which was mostly like middle class and upper class until the socialist sort of regime came. And so in that regard, it really was bringing the revolution to Bulgaria and Romania and creating a new scale. But then they saw actually what Bulgarian and Romanian architects were doing, and it was very much an interest in their innovation and their different approach to the built environment. And so they send delegations to Bulgaria, to Romania, and bring back all sorts of new ideas. They're very interested, for example, the Romanians are developing seismic technology because of the threat of earthquakes there, and so they're interested in what the Romanians are developing in that field, and they bring back some of that technology. So I think it is a sort of... But then they're recognizing that the creation of the mass health resort, nevertheless, is a Soviet creation. So it is a tension between the two sides.
What fun that suggestion is. I'm thinking to myself, if one could read down in the documents and find the Soviets going to international meetings or having exchanges with their colleagues in Eastern Europe and in the West, what would they say when they came home? Would they, I'm just thinking, would they say, we went with the following experience behind us, but we were quite stunned by what the Czechs or the Bulgarians were doing? Or would it be a matter of pride for them to say, we went with the following experience, but we were quite stunned by what the Germans were doing? And always I remember the statement, it's our Germans versus your Germans. I remember hearing that when I was in Russia. And I think that... You know, one would have to really drill down in those documents. I don't know.
And it actually is true that they're talking about, they also learn about new developments in France. There's Languedoc-Roussillon, this mass resort that's being built, and they learn about that. And they really are, in some ways, just assimilating from both and contributing to both models.
One example which sprung to mind, which I'm trying to disentangle, is the most well-known Soviet psychiatrist is Andrei Snezhnevsky, much maligned, involved in this diagnosis of sluggish schizophrenia and very much involved in the political abuse of psychiatry. But there's interesting things going on with Snezhnevsky, because he actually was very closely linked with an East German psychiatrist, Karl Leonhard, who had a remarkably similar longitudinal approach to schizophrenia and the idea that schizophrenia could develop gradually. And Leonhard's research, in turn, was actually developed in the 1930s in Frankfurt. Like, there was nothing Soviet about it at all. And there's letters between the two. Snezhnevsky and his team come over. They also meet with Norwegians. And so even the kind of archetypal big, bad Soviet psychiatrist actually was looking to justify his psychiatry and theories through these superior Germans, in a way. So it's always much more messy than you think.
Maria and then Dora. Yes, just very brief response to Susan's previous, let's say, provocation of insiders and outsiders, along the line of Susan, for Sarah, who commented just after your provocation. I would say that being an insider does not necessarily mean having the same influence.
Having the same influence with
the others. Yes, you are an insider, but how much influence do you have? And the question is, upon whom do you have? Do you want to have this influence? This is the one question that we have to think about it. And of course, along the line of Sarah, I mean, is the contribution of the insiders is recognized in the same way as the contribution of the, let's say, the main or the powerful players, if I may say so. The insiders, this distinction insider and outsider is, as you said at the beginning, not cemented, let's say. It doesn't have cemented borders, let's say.
I just also wanted to react. I didn't mean to argue that I would think that the Soviets are outsiders. I think there are two issues here. The question of this insider outsider or stranger as thinking about, like, in you know, being in the moment contemporarily in the interwar era or the early Cold War. But there's also the outsider to a historiography of international health, and you know which it is. Apart from moments of, like, really well-known moments of smallpox eradication, or, you know, like, where the Soviet Union really comes up and shines, and, you know, like, but then it's the Americans who do it. These narratives are completely missing, and they are considered as outsiders to what we call international health, and obviously none of us in the room think so. Which is partly why we're here, but I'm also interested in how we get there, that these narratives completely fall out and completely disappear, even though they're much more thought about much more critically in the moment.
Historical periods are really important here. I mean, we don't want to generalize over a tremendously long period, because there are important nuances of difference I see even between what Johanna's describing, you know, from 53 on, say, to the 70s, that's largely speaking one period, 1921 to 37. There are a variety of periods. I guess, Dora, my question is, when we talk about outsiders or insiders, are we looking for leading figures? Are we looking for paradigm disruptors? Are we looking for paradigm confirmers? I mean, how do we judge exactly what the contribution is? I have confidence that the Soviets, certainly in the first 15 years after the fledgling regime was founded, saw themselves
as moving forward and hoped that they would be, not only that they would be fully accepted, but that what they thought they had to offer international public health would be recognized as such. That from all the documents I read, seems to be quite clear.
I'm sorry, it's always the same question. You're the Rubakin, who is partly outsider and insider, but the same is true of the Rockefeller resident directors. They fit your definition of the stranger. They come today and stay tomorrow, up to the point of coming as advisor and staying as administrators. They seem to know my rights in Greece, or etc., etc. So at the end, what is specifically Soviet? In the Rubakin case or in others you may have in mind?
Such a good question.
I'm thinking to give a definition of the stranger.
So I'm thinking not of Norman White, let me think about Alan Gregg, who goes around fact-finding. This is my own personal point. No, there's a specific point. Alan Gregg, I think, leaves initially for Russia thinking that he has a way of doing public health business. But in his diary, he writes that when he gets there, he loses his sense of mooring, that he feels, and this is one of the most interesting things I've found, that he's off bounds, and the further away he is from New York, the more he feels he doesn't really know. So would he be like the stranger? Not quite. I think of him as a fact finder. He's going to figure it out. I don't think Rubakin is a fact finder. I think he's engaged in cultural diplomacy. I think that's what the Soviets were doing. He has to scope out the local situation, figure out where he can make inroads. That's a quick answer, Leon. I'm sure it's not as reflective as I'd like it to be, but it might work to push the discussion further. I don't know.
Do you have any final
questions,
Johanna Zara?
I was going to quickly comment or raise some more questions from Dora's comment. One of the things that still strikes me is that I think for Hungary as well, in fact, the only exception I can think of is East Germany, is that in terms of historiography, the people who are writing about history of medicine, often, apart from yourself, but you went to the States to do your PhD, often are external in some way. So there's a handful of historians in the Czech Republic at the moment. I'm not sure there's any in Slovakia. But the main people are either in the US or here or Finland, for example. And so there isn't really a homegrown historiography going on. And then why would, for example, British historians necessarily look at that part of the world, or German historians necessarily? So I wonder whether that's one of the reasons. And I can't account for why that's the case. You may have a better perspective in terms of Hungary.
I love that there's a different layer of outsiders, but also one is that even the historians are themselves outsiders.
Well, I'd make a final comment about the question of what makes Soviet medicine distinctive. It's a question that you can always go back to. It's the well that keeps on pouring. And it's I've recently been rooting Soviet health policy beyond 1917 in discussions of the Second International, and actually finding that these are shared socialist roots in many of these approaches. Well, social hygiene is certainly one that goes beyond 1917, and that we can see the Soviet version of sort of their approach to medicine as a variant not only of sort of Western traditions of medicine, but also a variant of what is a distinctive socialist approach to health that you can trace back. And part of this is the focus on prevention, and but it's not distinctively socialist, but it's unleashed by the state from above, by the Soviets when the Bolsheviks take power. So there's more focus on prevention. And then what I see as distinctive in my interdisciplinary work, I see they have more potential to work in urban planning because of the land reforms and that you have in the Soviet case that you don't have elsewhere. The Weimar Republic never manages to nationalize their health resorts, whereas the Soviets take over the health resorts, build new cities, and so they have more scope to work in more directions with their environmental approach to health. So,
can I just have one come back at that question? Because I think it's really intriguing. When any of the Rockefeller officers went out, from the beginning, even Rose in the diaries, you see, there's a ticket. He has a ticket. He has a point of departure and he has a likely point of return, whether it's on a boat or however. Mm-hmm. He's what Zimmel would call the wanderer. He comes today, he stays for 2 weeks, he does his work, he goes home. The interesting thing about the Soviets is not only what their approach to public health was, but these Soviet representatives were charged with, and it's a horrible word, you can't use it anymore, becoming embedded. That the more embedded in the local situation they became, the better work. Whereas Greg was told to meet the right people, but he wasn't told to become embedded. In fact, it was really important that the Rockefeller officers maintained a certain distance, intellectual distance. So just let me throw that out because it hit me after. I think that's a fairly fundamental difference, in addition to the one that, of course, you rightfully signal as number one.
To becoming a better is to going native.
To going native, that's right.
That's from China.
Yes.
In China, or everywhere.
Yeah.
To go native,
yeah.
And in Andhra, the worst thing you could do is...
Right.
Also
that's right.
Yeah,
of course. Yeah. Worst thing you could do.
On that note, thank you very much. It was a very wonderful panel and discussion. And I think the bunch is ready, right?
Yeah. Yep. I think doing a great job. And you didn't have to close us down. Thank you.